Welcome back to Season 8 of Talking with Traders. This is the fourth year of this podcast since it began in 2020. Once again, IG Markets have come on board as the sponsor of this podcast. We're truly grateful and privileged to have such a global leader in CFD trading as our sponsors. In the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing various guests from around the globe on the topic of trading. Some of these will be past guests that we invite back onto the podcast, and some will be new guests. The idea is to attract a broad spectrum of different perspectives from players in different areas of the markets. None of what you hear here is financial advice, but it is intended to get you thinking about how you might be able to apply what you hear here to your own trading and investing. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be notified when new episodes are released. Once again, thank you to IG Markets for sponsoring this podcast into its fourth year. And thank you, listeners, for your continued support of this podcast. Now let's get into this week's episode. Welcome back to another episode of Talking with Traders. And it is my great pleasure to welcome back a regular guest, I guess we can say, Anthony Clark from Small Talk Daily Research. Anthony's been on this podcast each of the 4 years that we've been doing the podcast. Anthony, we started in 2020 and you've been a guest every year. You didn't actually feature in 2023, which is my fault. But anyway, we're making up for it today. This is your fourth appearance on Talking with Traders. And it's always a joy speaking to you. It's always a joy catching up and getting your insights on the small and mid-cap space in South Africa. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Garth. It's nice to be back. It's slightly stormy here in Cape Town, but you know, we live through the storms, be it the economy, the political scene, or even the forthcoming election, and we just traverse it.
Well, this, I think saying it a little bit stormy in Cape Town right now, I think it sounds like a bit of an understatement from all the video footage that I've seen of roofs blowing off houses and trucks blowing off the Huguenot Tunnel Bridge, etc. It looks like it's been a pretty hectic couple of days there in the Cape. So I hope you're all keeping safe.
Yeah, we are. I was away for a week, but so much for a holiday. I was actually working on a project for a client, but it was nice to get away.
Good, good. So, Anthony, I thought it's particularly pertinent to be speaking to you now because this is an election year in South Africa, and well, not only in South Africa, in large parts of the democratic world, actually, and not so democratic in some cases. There are elections happening all over the world this year, but we're going to focus particularly on South Africa. And this election coming up is obviously a pivotal one. You know, on our previous podcasts, you've mentioned to me that you've been an analyst covering South Africa and covering the JSE since the early 1990s, which is a time when I was still in high school. But you were a young analyst at that point in time. But obviously, we know the early 1990s, and particularly 1994, was an interesting time for South Africa. It was a turbulent time. Things could have gone either way. And I mean, many are saying that this election that we're having now in 2024, 30 years after the first democratic elections in the country, this election is likely to be probably the most important and the most pivotal election that the country has had since 1994. And again, I guess we find ourselves in a situation where South Africa is very, very cheap in terms of its valuation, or South Africa Inc., let's call it that, on the JSE is desperately cheap. I've seen some reports saying that some of the valuations right now are actually even cheaper than where they were at the depths of the COVID pandemic. So South Africa is very, very cheap. Now, I guess part of that could be due to uncertainty heading into the election, weak economic environment, et cetera, et cetera. We can list all the reasons. But if we go back and we think to 1994, you know, that was a time when South Africa was also at a very uncertain stage about its future. And it would have been easy to write the country off at that stage. We're kind of in a similar situation now, I suppose. So where do you stand on that? You know, do you think South Africa Inc. is offering a generational contrarian buying opportunity at these depressed valuations, like I guess one could have said it did in 1994? Where are you standing on that?
That is an extremely interesting and detailed question. And to answer the first part of your question, I'm much older than I look. So in 1994, I've been covering the JSE for the best part of probably 7 years. And I remember vividly the transition from the apartheid government to the democratic government and the government of national unity for the first 2 years. I first came to this country in May 96, but prior to that, I was working in London covering the JSE and visiting family here from 1985 at the height of the Troubles. So I had vivid memories of what was going on. I have to caveat my first part that I'm not a political analyst, never have been, never will be. I'm certainly not that clever. But what I do have is an understanding of the universe that I cover going back for the best part of nearly 35 to 40 years. And having lived through the cycles, as you say, from 1994, if you go all the way through to the Russian crisis, Lehman Brothers, you name it, I've been through it. And you are correct. The underlying valuations of the JSE Small to Mid Cap Index is at levels I have not seen probably in the best part of over 20 years. But I have to say that from 94, when there was an air of risk regarding how would the election go in 94, what would emerge afterwards? Would the government of national unity actually work? Would the country actually coalesce into a country that could move forward, given the traumatic and turbulent times that happened before 1994, which we're all very well aware of and should never occur again? So there was an air of risk, but also hope. And given that post 94 saw an upsurge in hope, I often remind viewers, particularly those who are slightly younger than me, which I think is most people these days, that the JSE back in the 90s was the 10th largest stock market in the world. Right now, we have sunk into virtual oblivion, given what's been going on with the delistings and the currency. When I first came to this country, I think I converted the pound to the rand at about 3 or 4. We're now at 24. The dollar rand has gone to hell in a handcart. So I think the environment back then was far different than it is now. Back then, we had a hope that the country would coalesce and investment would come in. And there was a great deal of international belief that the country would pull itself together and be a beacon of hope in a post-traumatic apartheid era. And it was for many, many years. And then, of course, we know what happened with Mbeki being ousted, Zuma coming in, the lost 9 years, the rise of corruption, looting, state capture, and the fact that the current president, Ramaphosa, the great hope for perhaps rescuing the country from the doom and gloom of the Zuma era, would try and resurrect that hope, which clearly, as we all know, has not happened. It's in fact gotten worse. We all know the stats regarding the perceived state capture numbers. We know what's going on with Eskom. Day by day, I'm sure you internationally, alongside many other listeners to this podcast, read about the failures of this government regarding infrastructure, ports, rails, harbour, education, defence, you name it. Everything is collapsing. And interestingly, even some of these state-owned enterprises, which perhaps are not on your radar, which I keep an eye on, like the state forestry industry, Safcol, or Alexcor, the diamond company, or Foscor, the phosphate company, are all in a state of collapse. And they all have a ripple effect on the underlying economic interests of this country. So I think that 30 years on, this is a pivotal election, not because there is economic hope. It's pivotal because we are in a transition. We all know that when liberation leaders start losing their way, we've seen it in many countries in Africa. And I don't have to be an economist or a political analyst to regale this. It is commonly written that liberation movements tend to do anything to stay in power. And I think the great unknown right now is we have no idea what will happen post May the 29th. We have no idea what level of support the ANC as a dominant party will get. Could the MK party under Jacob Zuma get sufficient votes to become a potential kingmaker? Could Julius Malema of the EFF be the same? Could a certain coalition be put in place which could potentially be detrimental to the economic and political scene in this country? Could the golden ticket occur? Would the ANC partner with the DA? Who knows? At this stage, nobody knows. And I think that's the reason why we've got economic uncertainty, political uncertainty, currency uncertainty, and everybody is holding their money on the sidelines. I can tell you at the start of this quarter, there's been above average trade of the JSE, particularly in the small to mid cap space, as funds are looking to de-risk from what they call domestic listed stocks. And I've seen it. But interestingly, the currency has strengthened. We've gone from 19 to the dollar to about 18.57 this morning, which again is counterintuitive given what's going on. So you've got varying signals which seem to be at crosshairs as to what is actually going on. And I think the solid answer is nobody knows. And as you and I both know, having been around for a long time, in times of uncertainty, what do people do? They do nothing and they sit on cash. And I think they sit back and they wait for clarity. And, you know, at some point in early June, we will know which way the sticks will fall, who is governing, and what the economic landscape will look like in terms of economic policy, interest rate policy, and political policy going forward. Because if it's ANC, MK, EFF, it'll be far different to ANC, DA.
Yeah.
And I think that's why right now we are sitting purely, as you say, on a knife edge. It'll go either way. I've seen reports, again, to be in my usual vernacular, if it goes the wrong way, the rand is going to hell in a handcart. If it goes the right way and we have a golden ticket, I could easily see the rand strengthening. And there is 1.5 trillion rand of cash in corporate balance sheets waiting to be invested if it goes the right way. If it goes the wrong way, why the hell should they invest? Because we know what will happen in the next 5 years if it goes the wrong way. And the same is true here in the Western Cape. We had the DA leader the weekend scaremongering, saying the Western Cape is the last great wealthy piggy bank in the country. And if it goes the wrong way, it'll get looted to hell. So we are in a very interesting situation. But saying that, my job is to look for permutations in the market, in the stocks that I cover, all 78 of them. And I see compelling value. But as I said to a major client this morning with an enormous client base in this country, why the hell would you do anything right now and put your money at risk when you have no idea what's going to happen on May the 29th? I'd rather pay a little bit more in early June than risk my money right now with not knowing where the cards will fall and where the dice will roll.
Okay. Very well said. Very well said indeed. Okay, now let's talk about a couple of stock specifics, though, because this is obviously your area of expertise. And I do want to go back to some of the stocks that we spoke about on previous podcasts, just to revisit them. And in fact, some of these stocks really exist because of the failings of the government that you've alluded to so clearly there. We're looking at, you know, Grindrod, Curro, and Invicta. They were stocks that you liked previously. And certainly Grindrod and Curro have done pretty well since the last time we spoke. I'd like to get your updated views on those. And then Invicta hasn't really done anything. It's pretty much at the same price as it was when we spoke 18 months ago. But let's go through those each one by one, if we can, Anthony. Let's start with Grindrod and get your views there.
Yeah, Grindrod has been a stock that I have been recommending since R3.71 all the way back in November 2020. At that point, it had a significant discount net asset value, but the company was in a bit of a disarray. Andrew Waller, the then CEO, had a mandate to clean up the company, sell non-core assets. Grindrod had morphed into a disparate basket of unrelated companies, from agricultural interests to private equity, banking, land, you name it, away from its core, you know, logistics, ports, operation. And Andrew Waller did that quite succinctly. He exited many of the underlying assets. And when he stepped down last year to hand over the chair to Kulani, the current CEO, a much cleaner company emerged. What we then saw is that a lot of the non-core assets which were creating noise around the company, particularly the risk of Grindrod Bank, were sold for extraordinary sums of money that went to African Bank. That led to a cleaning up of the structure. Debt was repaid. And as the company got back to its core, ports, rail, and logistics operation, the market had some clarity and line of sight to the underlying potential and the earnings inside the company. And then, of course, given the government failings with Transnet, which are very well known on the rail situation, and Portnet, where I think in the last rankings that I saw, the South African ports were amongst the worst performing in the world, which is a staggering indictment regarding the economic failures in this country. Companies which had independent port operations in Maputo and in Walvis Bay in Namibia, which Grindrod does. So they have Walvis Bay in Namibia and Maputo in Mozambique. It is intuitive that private enterprise in this country wishing to get their goods from point of production, be it grain from the fields or chromite and iron ore from the mines to port, would bypass, Richards Bay, Durban, Cape Town, and use alternative ports. And they would use efficient operators to get it there, which is exactly what has happened. And Grindrod, from 3.71, I think hit a peak north of 12 rand. It's hovering now, the same sort of level. And we've had latterly the government come out with PPPs, particularly in rail and in ports, even though the port infrastructure is currently being challenged by Maersk, who's a joint venture partner of Grindrod in Durban. You may recall that the Durban port was given to a Filipino operator. So there's questions on that as well. But the overall arc is that the government needs help, and private industry are the only people who have the resources and the skill to actually assist the government in moving goods from point A to point B. And that's been the great hope for private enterprise. And Grindrod is probably the only listed JSE company which has direct exposure to PPPs. They have rail infrastructure, they have assets, they have logistics, they have ports, and they've been proven operators. And I think with Rembrandt exiting its stake a year and a half ago, or a year ago, freeing up a free float, people can see the potential in that company. And the recent results, which I attended a few weeks ago, again highlight that the company's done fantastically well. I have a target price of 16 rand on Grindrod. It has made and attained every single one of my targets since November 2020. And I think it's one of the very few infrastructure plays in this country which has continued legs. And let's not forget that as PPPs start rolling out, we have seen major international companies buy out infrastructure companies in Africa, DPI and Bulleir as an example. And as such, Grindrod, to me, alongside of being an excellent operator with potential in rail and infrastructure, could also be a takeover target. And it certainly is not going to be a 12 rand. I have major institutional clients with substantial stakes, and they will not let this cherry trophy asset go cheaply. So I'm a Grindrod shareholder. I have been for many years, and I'm certainly not a seller. So to me, it remains one of the bluest mid-cap stocks that I cover, and certainly not one in the near term that I would be selling.
Okay, very good. Okay, and that 12, 16 rand price target from the current area of around about 12, that's what's it about 30% upside from the current level. So that's pretty juicy. All right, and then let's talk about Curro, the private school operator that was born out of the PSG group. This was also one that you liked previously, and it has done quite well since the last time we spoke. Where are you standing on that now?
Yeah, again, I just gave a presentation this morning on the overall school sector, which is Curro, Avatech, and Stadio. And in late 2022, I went out on a limb at 8 rand with a very strong buy recommendation on Curro. And I think many of my clients must have thought that I'd either taken some hallucinogenic drug or clearly been caned very hard by a teacher to give such a recommendation, given the stock had been badly underperforming the education sector. But what has happened in the last couple of years is there's been a transition in management where the founders and the educational management inside the stock have been replaced by what I would call not more professional, but more of an accounting bent. So Kobus Loubser is the current CEO who has no education experience. His background is in retail. He comes from Holdsport, and he's had a number of executive positions in what I would call top line retail environments, where the management of debtors' books and the collection of money is quite crucial to the running of a retail business. No one wants to have a credit book at a large fashion or retail enterprise with substantial delinquencies and bad and growing debtor books. So I likened Curro to being like a retailer, except the products it was selling wasn't clothes or footwear, but it was learning, and the customers were children. But the ultimate customers were the parents who were paying the fees to educate their children. And education in this country, as it is globally, is a very emotive subject because in this country, you want your child to have the best possible start in life, given the difficulty in finding employment as a young adult in this country. So you need a good grounding, no matter what your creed, color, ethnicity, or background. So it's very important. But at the end of the day, a schooling company is a business. And I likened Curro at one point to being nothing more than an NGO or a charity, where it did quite well. But at the end of the day, it was perhaps a little bit too lenient. And when Cobus Lobscher came in, he was a little bit more aggressive with collecting fees from errant parents who perhaps, gave sob stories. And this may sound very cavalier of me to say, but I'm a child of a Thatcher era of 1980s, where capitalism is embedded in the council house blood of my veins. And if you've got 72,000 learners, and perhaps 65,000 are paying, and perhaps seven are not, in the old days, Currer would have slapped him on the wrist and said, there, pay when you can. Under Cobus Lobscher, he said, not a chance. If you can't pay, your child is out. And so it's a bit like, I call it Truworths. If Truworths has errant customers on his credit book, you are not going to get credit to buy new clothes. That's how they've become one of the most successful retailers in this country. Currer did exactly the same. If you couldn't pay your bills, sadly, your child had to leave the point of learning, and we replaced those learners with customers or learners that actually had a much better ability to pay. So imagine having a debtor's book with a near perfect payment record. It's significantly better than one with just maybe 80 or 85% ability to pay. And it's that momentum which has transformed the underlying earnings of Currer Holdings, and that's why the stock has run. However, in results this year, which again, for second consecutive year, alongside the entire education sector, has seen double-digit growth in earnings, and all the education stocks for the last 2 years have had above-average growth, which the market didn't expect. Currer came out with a significant impairment of 28 of its schools, which basically reinforced the market's view that it expanded too quickly. It took on too much capacity, which was not filled fast enough, and took too much debt on board. In a rising interest rate environment, that finance cost has come back to bite it in the bum. And even though it's filling up its schools better than it has been, there's still some latency in the capacity utilization. And this impairment of those 28 schools, even though it was re returning a reasonable rate of return, it wasn't meeting its WACC rate. And as such, a market thought, well, hell, the company is now reinforcing what we have believed is wrong with the company, and the share price has weakened in the first quarter of 2024. In 2023, it was the best performing education stock by far. But in 2024, we've now got Currer year to date, sorry, Currer in the last 12 months, up 38%, Advertech up 62%. It's had a hell of a re-rating in the last 3 months. And Stardew only up 3.3% because it was on a very juicy rating. So I'm certainly not caning Currer. Advertech has run for its own reasons. But Currer, I think, has just been sidelined because some of the optics coming out on the accounting side have not been to the market's liking. And until interest rates start to fall in this country, the debt burden will continue to weigh on the company. And until it gets over that capacity utilization hump, I think the stock will just tread water. So I still like the company. I certainly wouldn't be selling it, but I certainly wouldn't be rushing out anytime soon to buy it, given May the 29th. Education in this country is going to become interesting, but as it stands right now, I have a neutral weighting on all education counters, not because I do not believe in the sector, but I do not believe in having risk ahead of May 29th.
Okay. All right, very interesting. And I want to quickly touch on Stardio while we're talking about private education. We'll still talk about Invicta in a moment, but Stardio is the tertiary education business that was born out of Currer a couple of years ago and separately listed on the JSE. Now, you mentioned that that one's not done very much over the last 12 months. Where are you standing on that? I mean, you say you're neutral on all of the education players. Obviously, Stardio fits into that sector as well. Where are you on Stardio now?
Yeah, longer term, if I had to be in any education counter longer term, if I only wanted to be in education in this country, it would be in Stardio. Why? It's in tertiary education. Again, the state-owned universities are all failing. There's been no new capacity built in the state sector for quite some time. We know that the higher education department is in one hell of a mess. And the rise of private colleges, which are kicking down the door for university status, is growing louder day by day. And I have to say, I'm not a parent, but if I was a parent, looking at some of the volatility and the rebel activity that's been going on at certain universities in this country, with fires happening at certain places and what you would call acts of vandalism and unwanton destruction. Would I want my young teenage son or daughter going to certain schools, given what is going on in the state system? Perhaps not. Perhaps I would send them to a tertiary education operation that is run by Advertec or by Stadio to get an equivalent qualification, which has the same excellent merits and standing, rather than sending them to a state school where perhaps there could be disruption. We've all seen what goes on around exam time when things get a little bit awry, when perhaps exams are too difficult or the marks are not too good. And I say that tongue in cheek, but it's true. And I think that's why Advertec and Stadio are very well placed in the longer run. And another interesting fact, 88% of Stadio's learners are now online. And we have seen a rise in emigration in this country. And interestingly, most of the learners inside Stadio are learning education. Out of Stadio's near 40,000 learners, one third are studying some form of education qualification. Now, why would that be? Easy. If you want to leave this country and get a job offshore, people always want teachers. So I've written on this fact. I've had a buy on Stadio since Freerun 62, going back to September 2022. And it got to a high of 5.50. We're now back to about 4.50 in round numbers. If you were a young person in this country, or even someone of a more mature age, not as old as me, who'd want to enhance their career abilities to either rise on the ladder or perhaps improve my chances of getting a better job in a very difficult economy we are in right now, what better way to enhance my career prospects than by improving my BCom or by getting an MBA or some form of secondary qualification to enhance my prospects? And that's what people are doing, either to enhance their prospects for a career in this country, to keep up with what's going on in varying legislative requirements, and or perhaps to improve their chances of getting a job outside of a country. So for me, Stadio, given its asset light, it remains a long-term play, but I have to caveat. They mentioned in their recent results they're about to start entering a large CapEx cycle. And when I say large, it's not as large as Advertec or Curro. They're building a new campus in Durbanville. So they'll move from a net cash position to a modest net debt position. So they'll probably go from 100 million rand cash to maybe 200 million rand debt, which is small in the scale of things. But it still slightly changes the balance of the company until that campus is built and paying its way. So I think there might be a bit of a water treading in Stadio until things get going. But as it stands right now, I think the natural demand for tertiary education in this country will always be there. And as such, I want to be in an asset light online business. And currently, the best player in that segment is Stadio. And let's not forget that in the last few weeks, we've had Educor, which owns the Damlin brand in this country, basically fall over and lose its accreditation by the Department of Education. And that left several thousand learners high and dry. We've had UNISA, which is basically the latest education body in the government, falling down. That has over 350,000 learners. If even a fraction of those move over to Stadio, given its 40,000 learners, there is natural runway for growth inside Stadio in the longer term. So again, in the short term, I have a neutral recommendation, not because I do not like the sector. It's all about risk mitigation because of the election cycle. For this next quarter, I'd rather sit on cash and wait and see what happens. If things go the right way, I'd rather pay a little bit more for my stock. If it goes the wrong way, I can pay a lot less.
Okay. Well said. All right. And then let's quickly take a look at Invicta. We're going through these companies, but it's always interesting to hear all of your views on all of these. Invicta is a industrial business, manufactures widgets for, large industry. It's a company you liked a lot the last time we spoke, but its share price hasn't really done very much over the last 18 months. How are you seeing Invicta at this point in time?
Yeah, I was discussing Invicta this morning again in one of my client reviews. This morning, it was trading at 26 rand 50, which year to date is down 6.7%. And Invicta has been in a very narrow trading range between 25 and 29 rand since July 2022. So it's basically gone nowhere. At the end of the day, you can trade the stock at 25 and sell it at 29. And it's just been a consistent, trade up and down. So the issue with Invicta is a very interesting one. I actually spoke to Stephen Joffe, the CEO, yesterday and last week, given their latest transaction in the UK. They bought a company in the UK called Nationwide Bearings, or NWB, which follows on from their transaction in January 2023, where they bought a company called KMP, involved in automotive parts. So Invicta, as it stands right now, is over 50% rand hedged, given its material operations in Southeast Asia and China in Tianan, and its growing operations in the UK and in Europe. So it has a nice rand hedge component, but I think the market is missing that. I think the market is just purely focused on the fact that the domestic economy and Invicta's exposure to the mining sector and the industrial sector has seen reasonable growth. But the market is focusing, saying, well, Invicta is still an SA play. And because the SA economy, or SA Inc., is not doing that well, as we all know, with mediocre, if not, I was going to say terrible, economic growth and economic policies, with an increasingly militant and communistic stance coming from the Department of Trade and Industry, there's no growth. And why would you want to invest here? And if people are not investing here, the demand for varying, spare parts and widgets and products will always remain, because things will break down and they'll need repairing. But there's a very old English saying that goes back to the Second World War. It's called make, do, and mend. And if things are not going well, perhaps you will not replace your spare parts as often, or perhaps you will take cheaper parts. When times are tough, you're not going to buy an original Toyota part if you can buy a cheap Chinese knockoff. And I think that's beginning to start playing on certain companies in this country. So growth is there, but it's very low growth. It's low single digits. So in Invicta's case, they're looking to augment their business by buying assets offshore. But here they're hamstrung. They can't place paper because the stock is trading on a PE of probably about five or six. So you can't place paper. You can't issue debt because, your currency is worth nothing. If you want to expand overseas into euros, dollars, or pounds, you are often outbid. Invicta last year had a very, very interesting opportunity to buy a really, really good company in Cleveland in the US in automotive parts, which would have really powered its international growth into the North American market. They bid what I thought was a fair price, but what happened? Private equity came along, doubled the price, and Invicta sadly could not compete because it doesn't have a balance sheet. And that's the problem for many South African companies. The weak rand and the inability to match international private equity pricing means that they are somewhat precluded from many, many markets because they simply do not have the spending power of private equity. So Invicta, sadly, is stuck in a rock and a hard place. Its domestic market is pedestrian. It picks up nice assets offshore, but not of scale to give it that hit that it needs to de-risk its SA operations. And as one of my large clients told me earlier this year, Anthony, everyone in this country owns Invicta. Pretty much every fund owns it. Until a new body comes in who but wants to buy Invicta, there's no one out there to buy it. So we need somebody to come in and say, we love this story, to drive it higher, because it is illiquid. So we've got a great company trading on a low PE, which has been completely restructured and all its debt and tax issues mitigated by CEO Stephen Joffe in the last 3 years. But you know what? The market doesn't care. And it'll only start to care when something dramatic happens. And sadly, in the near term, nothing dramatic is going to happen. So on a relative basis, you have not lost money, but you just haven't made any. You've just made dividend flow, and that's it.
Okay. All right. And then it would be remiss of me to leave out Renergen. So this is obviously a stock that is in the helium gas space and in the Free State. It was all the rage in 2021 and 2022. The share price ran up to, I think, north of 35 or nearly 40 rand a share, I think.
43 Rand, yeah.
43 rand, yeah. And I know you were bullish on the company, but you did also caveat last time, because when we spoke the last time, it was just sort of starting to roll over. And I think it was trading just south of 35 Rand at the time. It had already peaked and it was looking kind of toppish. And you did say at that stage you felt it was, you know, there was too much good news being priced into the stock and that it had been massively hyped up by the retail buying public. And that although the story was a good story, one needed to take a sort of a 8 to 10 year view on the company, and perhaps the market had got ahead of itself. And what I often find with these types of growth stories is kind of what's happened at this at Renergen. I guess if you think about an S, but turn it backwards and then turn it on its back, so you get that initial growth, but in the share price, which is the hype that comes along with, you know, all the future prospects and the excitement, but then the share price gets disconnected from the reality at the time and becomes too expensive, becomes a bubble. Then you get the bursting of the bubble, which is like the roller coaster down, and then you get a lengthy period of basing where the, you know, the weak hands get flushed out of the stock, the stronger hands slowly accumulate, and the base builds in the share price, and then eventually you get the actual growth story that was originally anticipated coming through, and that's what then drives the next leg of the share price to the upside. And we've seen that in many different industries, growth industries, which become hyped in the short term and then burst and then ultimately deliver the growth in the long term. I'm wondering whether Renergen is not exactly the same sort of situation here, where it's had that massive big push to the upside through 2021 and 2022, where the retail players came in en masse and bought the stock to ridiculous levels. It's now crashed. I mean, it's down at 11 Rand now, so you've lost 75% of your money if you bought it at the top. But it does look like it might be starting to base now. And that's why I think it's interesting to bring it back to the table and ask your views on the stock now, whether you agree with what I've said there or not. But where are you seeing Renergen? Give us an update on the stock.
Well, firstly, thank you for putting context and remembering what I said a good year and a half ago. I think you're one of the few that actually can contextualize what I said. The interesting thing is, as you know, I'm an institutional analyst, and my work generally only goes to the major institutions. And I often get vilified by the retail public, particularly on my social media platform, because they only see snippets of my work. And as such, the greater narrative, which only goes to my institutional base, is left out of a wider perspective. I've never been a retail chaser. But with the bursting of Renergen bubble, as I said, I was vilified. But again, people have short memories. And as you've just succinctly commented there, I did mention back in the day there was too much hype. Was I part of that in terms of running it up? The answer is partly yes. But we were in an environment back then, and people forget my first buy recommendation on the stock, I think, was in January 2021 from memory at 11 Rand. So we've gone from 11 Rand to 43 and back to 11 Rand. So depending on what point in the cycle you got in, you would have made a great deal of money. But as you say, the retail investor generally is late to the party. And when they jump on the bandwagon, it's when most people would be getting out. But in Renergen's case, you're right, the bubble did pop. The company, as I said back in the day, and as I wrote in a Financial Mail article in August last year, in a two-page special feature, the company was a victim of its own marketing spin. And as I wrote in that article, when I've written a fair bit on Renergen since, which the wider market has not seen, but my clients have. And again, I get slated for not commenting on the stock. I do comment on Renergen, but only to my clients. It's the old saying, you are not going to give away your IP to the wider world. So in Renergen's case, it fell to a low of round numbers 9 to 950, as the company basically missed a number of its own deadlines. The helium operation was perpetually delayed from June last year, and it still isn't up and running, which then naturally leads to, you know, the theories that there is no helium. Something's going wrong. It's a massive Ponzi scheme, and all sorts of spurious accusations come out from all sorts of quarters, which we've seen on social media, and with a company unable to defend itself because, you know, at the end of the day, it has to operate the business. You know how the market works. If you throw enough mud, something will eventually stick, even if perhaps the mud is not there in the first place. And we've seen in the last quarterly update, the company come out and say that the LNG operation is now up and running. The helium cold box has been fixed, and we're now trying to get the helium operation up and running. But it all adds to the narrative of a company, through its own marketing and its own inability to meet its own deadlines, shot itself in the foot consistently. And as I wrote in that August article last year, I was looking for seven boxes to be ticked regarding the production of LNG, the production of helium, the sale of a 10% stake in Tetra 4. They've sold 5.5% stake to Malacco Infrastructure for 550 million rand, which in theory values the whole of Renergen at 10 billion rand. The NASDAQ listing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And as these tick boxes are checked off, then I comment. So the wider retail universe says, you're not talking about Renergen. The answer is, I talk about Renergen as tick boxes are made. You cannot talk about something which has not occurred. So when the Malacco deal was done for 550 million rand, I said, there, it's done. It came late. It wasn't the Central Energy Fund coming in with 1 billion rand for 10%. It was a private equity stake sold for, 5.5% for 550 million rand. I said, do you really believe that the major debt funders for Energen, which is the Development Finance Corporation in the US, which is a multinational investment agency of the US government? We then had Standard Bank coming in with a debt facility, the largest bank in Africa coming in. Between those two, they offered to lend Renergen $750 million US dollars. We then had Malacco Infrastructure, which is one of the leading infrastructure funds in this country, do their own due diligence to put 550 million rand of their own money in. Do you not believe that those three entities would not have done their own exhaustive due diligences to check the underlying metrics that Renergen actually was a viable entity? But if you listen to social media, they didn't. They just went on a wing and a prayer. They stuck in some money, and it's all a massive Ponzi scheme. There's nothing there. Someone's got a helium balloon filled of gas, and they just squirted in a pipe. And I have to think to myself, are these people actually that naive that major international entities would not have done exhaustive due diligence? They also forget that the reserve and resource of Renergen was independently audited and verified a few years ago by the Canadian company Spool, which is the second largest energy consultancy in the world after Wood Mackenzie. Do you really think that a Canadian company can be easily fooled? Linde, one of the world's largest gases company, has independently verified the gaseous content of the operations in the Free State. Can they be hoodwinked? Well, clearly, according to some on social media, they all can be. So at the end of the day, you're going up against elements in the wider universe that no matter what you say, you are talking nonsense. It's a bit like, did Princess Diana really die in the tunnel in Paris, or was she assassinated by the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh? You will always get some people with spurious thoughts. But at the end of the day, the company itself was a victim of its own success. They talked a good game. They missed their own deadlines. The plant that they bought from China failed to operate succinctly. They're trying to fix it right now. And today, the share price is at 12.45. It's up 5%. The company has just had its quarterly filing and its year end. They are rushing to get their audit finalized because that audit will be used for the next filing at the SEC ahead of a potential NASDAQ listing. So the NASDAQ listing, I believe, is still on the cards, as is potentially the remaining 4.5% of Tetra 4, which might get sold to another party. So many of the moving parts inside Renergen are still moving, but they've now decided as an entity not to publicly comment, as they used to in the past, where they would issue a SENS if a CEO had a cup of tea and a Weetabix for breakfast. Now they only issue a SENS when something material has actually been concluded, which is what they should have been doing in the first place. Do not be telling me you've got two sugars in your tea. Tell me that you've actually done a deal and you've actually produced something. So they've listened to the market, they've listened to their shareholders, and they're now keeping quiet until things actually materialize. And I would think as I've written in that August article last year, that the final quarter of 2023 was one of the most important in Renergen's lives for actually getting operational activities bolted down, done and dusted. We are now at the 9th of April, as I look at my little clock here and the dog sleeping, thinking I'm really boring. And I think in the next quarter, we'll get a series of rapid updates from Renergen regarding LNG, helium, the listing, and potentially the remaining stake in Tetra 4. But it's all there waiting to transpire. I'm not going to say run out and buy it. It would be remiss of me to do so because it would go against my own risk mitigation strategy of not doing anything because of the election.
Right.
But all I'm saying is there are certain missives, I think, are coming from Renergen in the next quarter, which I think will turn the doubting Thomases on social media. And I think they'll be sorry that some of the mud that they've been flinging has been flung. But who knows? Only time will tell. But ask me in a year's time.
Yeah, okay. Well, Anthony, you know, there's a saying that the tallest trees catch the most wind. And and you're certainly the tallest tree when it comes to the small cap and mid cap analyst space in South Africa. So, you know, I guess there's no surprise that you're catching some of the wind on social media. You have to have broad shoulders.
Luckily I go to gym and I've got very broad shoulders. And I always say, and this may sound very strange to say, I'm an institutional analyst. I have been my entire life. If you're in the public spotlight, and I am in the Business Day, the Financial Mail, on TV and radio, at the end of the day, you have to have broad shoulders and you have to have a very thick skin. And I take it. I very rarely fight back because it would be wrong of me to do. I only fight back if they come after me personally.
Right.
You can come after my work. You can come after my recommendations. You can come after my views. But if you start coming after me as a person or my friends or my family or my beliefs or my being, that I think is fundamentally wrong. It's crossed the line.
Yeah.
And then you have to then fight back and block people. But as it stands, attack my work easily. My shoulders are broad enough and my experience and my standing in the market is enough to cope with that. So come at me. I welcome it. But if I'm right, I'm right. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. We are pretty much out of time, actually, Anthony. There were other questions I've wanted to ask you, but I think I've asked you the most important questions that I had put on the list that I sent to you before. Obviously, I know you're a busy man, and we can see those of you watching the video on YouTube will see that in the background there, Anthony's got a massive pile of papers and files on his desk, and that is testament to the hard work that you do analyzing all of these businesses that you do. I mean, one of the questions I was going to ask you is that with the number of delistings happening on the JSE, Grindrod Shipping is just now starting, is going to be leaving the JSE. MultiChoice looks like it's going to be next now that Canal Plus are moving on an acquisition there, although that might take some time. But all of these companies that leave the JSE, and often they are the best companies, you know, I guess it thins out your universe to some extent that you've got to cover. But nonetheless, with that being the case, I presume you're still very busy, notwithstanding the fact that the universe you cover is getting smaller.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first joined the stock market many years ago, there were 800 companies listed. I think the last number that I saw was about 286-ish. Yes, We Buy Cars is listening on the 11th. We're waiting for Coca-Cola bottlers. There's a couple of others on the go, but we've had significant amount of delistings on average over 20 a year for the last 5 or 7 years. But if you could see my little office here, the piles of files continue to grow. And the interesting thing is, even though the universe is getting slightly smaller, what is getting even smaller are the number of analysts that actually cover them. So I'm probably going to end up being the last man standing, where if you think of it logically, because of the universe is shrinking, it is unlikely that major brokers will actually have teams or analysts of repute covering this sector because it isn't worth their financial viability.
Yeah.
And with a number of brokers on the JSE vanishing as quickly as the companies, and the number of institutions who have the resources and the staff to look at the sector, you have to start then asking, well, let's ask that old bugger, Anthony Clark, who's been around for a long time, who's got the history and the memory to go back 30 or 40 years to actually help the young analysts to actually understand what is going on. Because most young analysts who enter the market start with small caps. They then gravitate up to the mid caps and the larger caps. So I think as long as there is a small to mid cap universe to play with, I will always be in work. And as I was teased latterly, I've never covered the retail sector. I've been fortunate to work with some excellent retail analysts in my career, and I certainly am not a retail expert. But one of my clients said recently, "Well, Anthony, Pick and Pay is now a small company. When are you picking up coverage?" So let's not forget that small companies become large companies, and in certain cases, large companies become small companies. And so there's always things that pop into my universe, either intentionally or sometimes unintentionally. And sometimes the unintentional stocks become interesting, or the intentional stocks become even more interesting. I was regaling this morning very quickly, but Quantum Foods, the small cap egg, poultry, and animal feeds business, is the best performing stock in the JSE this year. It's up 300% since the end of February, gone from 1 billion rand to 3.4 billion as of this morning because of a cat fight between two opposing parties to buy the company. I'm the only analyst that covers Quantum Foods. So you would think that I'm in somewhat of a demand given the story. See, I didn't know it was coming, but I've been following the story and talking about it. So every play, depending on the relevant or irrelevant side, often leads to a story. And if you're the only guy with that story and the history of that story, you will always be in demand. So maybe old and grey, there may be some Botox here and there, and the hair may be thinning. If I'm a last man standing covering the small to mid cap universe, hopefully I will always have a career to pay for my bills and dog food.
Well, there we go. And I was going to ask you about two things, the dog and the green beast, the Land Rover. How's that?
The dog is fast asleep here, clearly not that interested in what I'm talking about. He's now 4.5 years old, and as you know, he is the joy of my life and always will be. The green Land Rover is sitting downstairs, covered in dust, given the Cape Town storms. There has been an addition to the fleet. There's now a blue one as well, which I drive around every now and again. And I do this because old cars generally don't appreciate in value, and Land Rovers tend to hold the value quite well. So, as someone who does not like losing money, why should I buy a fancy new car when an old vehicle gets me around from A to B? And hopefully will last longer than any modern vehicle because there's no electronics to go wrong. And diesel will always be around. I will never be driving an EV car because I can't afford the electricity.
And sometimes the electricity is not there, as the case is in
Exactly.
South Africa. All right. Well, those Land Rover Defenders are very, very, very popular here in the UK, and they catch a good price as well. Anyway, we've run out of time, Anthony. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. As you say, you're the small cap analyst in demand because there's not many of you left, but also not only that, because you're a very, very good analyst and very, very eloquent in how you present things. And once again, it's been a great pleasure speaking to you. I'm very appreciative of your time. You've given me another hour of your time, and it's been great to catch up with you. And I certainly hope we can do this again maybe a year from now to catch up. And by then, we'll know what's happened in the election, of course.
Yes, I think it's all to play for. And as I was telling a client this morning, if I had a crystal ball, I would be immensely rich, and I would still be talking to you because no matter what is going on, I'm never retiring. And even if I won the Powerball lottery, which I think is now over 130 million rand, I'd still be here day in, day out because one, I'm too young to retire, and two, I never want to. So regardless of wealth or no money, if you love what you do, you will always be rich.
Absolutely. Well said. And on that note, I'm going to wrap it up. Anthony, thank you very much for your time. It's been excellent speaking to you once again.
Thank you, Garth. Have a good day.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Talking with Traders, brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a leader in the field of online trading involved in this series. Please follow us on Facebook and engage with us there. And a reminder to make sure you subscribe to this series by clicking on the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd also appreciate if you'd leave a review on the app too. Till next time.